outrider, someone who rides in front of or alongside a procession as an escort, a lookout, a vanguard. The outrider is separate from, but in communication with, the mainstream, pushing the boundaries, exploring, and reporting back from the frontier. Welcome to the Outrider Podcast, an ongoing conversation from the fringes of the mainstream. Hi.
Hi.
We have the wine going. It's called
That's nice.
The Other.
The Other. Oh, that's cool.
Yes.
So I bought myself something from my past that I like to drink, used to like to drink.
Yeah.
And have not drunk for many years as a treat because I literally spent most of my workday doing my taxes.
Today?
Today.
Ouch.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you go through the paperwork. It's not hard. It's just time consuming, right? And then there were a couple of mistakes. So every time there was a mistake that went through, for some reason, the document didn't save. And
wow.
So each time there was a mistake and they're like, nope, rejected. I was like, okay, great. Well, I'll just correct the mistake. Oh, it's blank again. So I just had to go through and like redo it every single time there was a mistake. So I got myself some Myers Dark rum, which is what I used to drink all the time
right in
college. And so that's what I'm drinking today. And have a beer on deck just in case I get through this. So.
Yeah, so let's start off with our usual thing of reading and writing.
Yay.
What are you reading right now?
I'm reading a few Substacks, one of which is very apropos to what we're talking about. Her newsletter is called Why Be Happy When You Could Be Writing? And it's actually really good, astute. It is really just good, astute essays on the process of writing, the craft of writing. She's a freelance writer herself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember her name because I don't have it in front of me on a separate screen. But yeah, that one's really fun. I'm reading I should have brought it into the other room with me. It's called The Science of Desire, I believe. And it's about how addiction is not a disease.
Right.
It's a fascinating pop, pop science book, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm going to get the author of that and actual title of that for you. But it's this amazing study about how the premise of treating addiction as a disease is actually really bad for addicts.
Right.
And how like other ways of going about getting over an addiction, it's very different. You need to look at it as not a disease because it's not actually a disease. And he goes into like neurobiology, how the brain changes its whole like connection system when it comes to like dopamine and stuff like that. It's fascinating. I'm only like a quarter of the way through it. So I will have more to say about it a lot once I get further down the road, but it's been fascinating so far. And that's kind of it. I follow a bunch of things on Substack. I just kind of like do some short form. Like I read the New York Times, like that kind of thing, you know. I'm trying to find really good nonfiction just because that's what I'm like super immersed in trying to shop this book out. So
right.
That's what I'm reading.
Well, I'm reading Gavin's book, Gavin Pate, Notes
Nice,
from the
Gavin.
Coming War. That's his collection of short fiction that just came out this year.
Great.
And I'm also reading Daniel Hoyt's This Book Is Not For You.
Tell me about this one.
But it turns out that this book probably is for me. Because, well, a couple of weeks ago, he came to WSU to do a reading for the MFA program. It was open to the public. And he teaches at K-State, my undergraduate alma mater.
Oh, right. Okay.
And we had met about 15 years ago, like right about the time my first book was coming out. And thankfully, he remembered who I was. So I went to that reading and bought this book. And then later that night, I came home, you know, went to go put it on my to-be-read shelf. And there was another copy of this book.
Oh.
I'd apparently bought it when it came out. It won the Zank Prize for Fiction back in the day. when it was first published.
Oh, I saw that post. You put a post about that up on your social media. You're like, this is what happens when you have a giant
to be read shelf. yes. So those are the two things I'm reading. This one, it's kind of a, it's told in a, the blurb here says it's told in a nonstop chain of chapter ones.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So every chapter is chapter one, but it, you know, of course, progresses normally. And the it's a first-person narrator named Neptune.
Huh.
Anyway, it's
I
it's
bet
amusing.
We're going to have some things to say about that as we talk about craft. It sounds really fascinating.
Yeah, it's I don't know that I have not read enough yet to really dive into it from a craft perspective, but yeah.
Okay. Well, and also I'm reading a lot of my students' work. I'm teaching a writer's workshop class right now, and we just started week four as of this recording. So,
right.
And it's a graduate students in the professional writing program at DU. And I think they're getting MAs.
Oh.
I actually don't know. It's an MA or an MLS. I don't know which one it is. What I know is that it's not an MFA. I think it's an MA. But anyway.
So mostly you're using Zinsser's book with them.
No, I can tell you what my... Yeah, that one's a good one. But no, I'm not using that one.
But that's... We're getting ahead of ourselves. What are you writing? What are you working on right now?
I am not working on my memoir. I'm shopping it out. So I'm working on paratexts for that one. I'm working on like... I tend to customize my book proposal for each place that I send it to.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm either sending it to... I had a suggestion for a publisher, so I'm going to send it to them. But I'm starting with agents. So
right.
I'm just sort of customizing my book proposal for each agent that I send it to. And I am writing for my Substack three times a week. And that's mm-hmm. beginning to be a lot more fresh stuff. There's some old stuff still going on, which is like old stuff that I'm refreshing and making better or fluffing,
right.
basically. I'm posting often enough that I'm starting to run out of good old stuff. So I'm starting to have to do more fresh stuff or taking seeds of an old piece that would not be relevant right now, but taking that as like a writing prompt, basically. So it's starting to be in this sort of liminal transition period between old work that I'm posting and then some new work. And I'm noticing that my way of writing creative nonfiction has changed immensely since my work on the memoir with my writing coach. It's been a very interesting process going through it with him, and him being an outside eye who doesn't actually know me. Like if I had you look at it, or like my partner or somebody who, even though you guys know all about how to read good work and know how to edit good work, you would still know me too well to be able to really give me the right feedback on it, right? So having this person who doesn't know me from Eve look at it was really helpful for me to be able to remove myself in a revision process. So now I'm noticing that whenever I do these raw pieces now, I'm like, oh, I can kind of almost get it as good myself, because now I know what to look for.
Right.
It's an entirely new process to me, and it's very fascinating. And I recently got a So there's that. And then thirdly, I got a poem published recently on a website called called Tart, TART.
Okay.
My poem appears on their spring art showcase. So there's visual arts and literary art posted on their online thing. I will give you an NSFW warning because it's a whole thing that, like, when you're looking on a device or even on a website, it's a showcase of all different kinds of art, right? So, but the first thing that pops up on the spring showcase is this very, like, very, very sexy kind of like artwork. You look really happy. You should be. It's really good. It's good stuff. But
does
like,
it have boobies on it?
So if you just like go to this website looking for my poem about druids and Halloween, and right. you see this like
accidental boobs.
giant orange hairy person masturbating, then you might like be shocked. Oh, so just so you know. It's good stuff. It's all good art. It's great stuff. But you know, you have to scroll down to find me, and you might have to scroll through some really interesting stuff. So,
right on. Cool. Congratulations. Awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. And you, what are you writing besides notes for this podcast?
I've been debating all day whether to mention this or not, and how to mention it, because for a long time lately, especially since finishing The Poison Moon and starting to send that out, and this year being very serious about sending it out, my personal bargain, my contract with myself is to send out that manuscript at least twice a month.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
This year.
Yeah.
So I have one more submission to make, maybe two this month. If I do two, it'll be three this month, but I need just at least one more this month. So technically I've kind of been just puttering around on other stuff to see what sticks, and nothing's really been sticking. And what I started this morning might not stick, but I've been thinking about it for a long time. And my first inclination was to write it as a screenplay. But I've decided that that's not the way to go, because I was letting that kind of block me at the process. I was trying to force it into a screenplay, and there's just part of me, no matter how much I try, I just can't outline a fictional piece of work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But you don't have to do that for a screenplay, do you? Can't you just write a screenplay organically?
But eventually you've got to shape it into the right sets of beats and yada, yada, yada.
Well, maybe revisions.
Right. In revisions. But I can't, the form is, I need to spend more time just fucking with the form.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, that makes
sense. Because it's the form right now is getting in the way.
Right.
And how to structure it and plan it out and not have it be like 800 pages or whatever.
That's fair. No, that's fair. Yeah.
So I don't know if you ever remember me doing this back in the graduate school days, but it's something that I've kind of done since I was an undergrad. And you know, sometimes it would happen when I was drinking or just when I was sitting around being goofy with people. And I would just kind of like, those were back during the crazy unconscious days when me and this donkey named Jorge were smuggling piñatas across the border into Tijuana. And we had a capuchin monkey that smoked pot and just got us in trouble. And I would just spin these like bizarre, stupid yarns.
Oh, I totally remember that. Yeah.
You know, about, the burrow hunk, Jorge and the monkey and the clown mafia and all this weird shit like that.
I mean, the clown mafia had great pot back in the day. It's like, it's definitely true. Yeah, no, I definitely remember that. Like we got to spin stuff. We never recorded any of them though. That was too bad.
Well, I finally decided to write that story. Of the crazy unconscious days.
I remember the crazy unconscious days. Wow.
So one of the things that I've found lately when I sit down and write, one of those things that I always have to do is I have to have a soundtrack.
Oh,
so
sure.
I go and build a playlist. Mm-hmm. But I also have to find an epigraph, really about the time that I start the novel, to kind of focus the story on what it's going to be. So like
it's almost like a prompt in a way, right?
Kind of, yeah.
Kind of?
The books I've written about my grandfather and have been trying to write about my father, those all have this John Berger epigraph from his, I think it was in Once in Europa. It's the middle book of the Into Their Labors trilogy by John Berger. And it said, and the line goes, "To refute a single sentence, it is sometimes necessary to tell a life story."
Wow.
As I think is the quote from Berger. So that was the quote, that was the epigraph that's kind of focused you know, those family mythobiographical novels and stuff like this. And of course, when I sat down to write The Poison Moon, the first quote I had was the Kerouac quote from Big Sur: "Nobody ever dares to tell the true story of love. It's awful.
It's awful."
The quote that I have, that the epigraph I'm using for to kind of focus and start this one off, and all of this ramble is because I don't want to actually tell the story before I tell it. We know that it's based off of my... It's going to be called Crazy Unconscious Days. It's based off of those ranty things that I used to do back, you know, just riffing off some weird, stupid idea. But
so great.
But the epigraph that's focusing that is a Joseph Campbell line where he says, "We must be willing to give up the life we planned in order to have the life that is waiting for us."
Yes.
And I have always struggled with that one because I know what it means, what he intended it to mean. You know, it's like we have to find the thing that really centers us. So yeah. I have that epigraph. And then the next one down, I put a second one in there. And the way I've put it on the page was, yeah, but what if my life, what if the life that's waiting for me is in a cubicle farm? You know, basically, like, I don't remember the exact way I phrased it. You know, what if the life that's waiting for me is you know, isolated, dying in a cubicle farm?
Right,
and
right.
That epigraph is by me. Right? So I have those two epigraphs played off at the beginning, and that's where I'm setting the tone for the Crazy Unconscious Days. Right?
Oh, that's great. Yeah, Campbell quotes tend to be like appropriated by the live, laugh, love, basic white bitches kind of crowd, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Follow your bliss.
Yeah, which
follow
is,
your bliss is not, it doesn't mean what you think it means.
It's not as simplistic like, as people interpret it to be, which is just do whatever makes you happy. No,
no,
I mean,
no.
Jerking off sometimes makes me happy, but that's not what you need to build a life around.
That's not your center of your being. I mean, is it? Hopefully it's not. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I know you're single still, but
right.
I'm just kidding. But you know, yeah. Like,
that's a solo. Well, I know it's real important to you now, living alone by yourself.
It's like one of many centers. No, but you know what I mean. Like it's these quotes can be lifted out of the rest of his thoughts.
Yeah.
Work and like be like really, really puerile.
Yeah. It's entirely possible to take any given Campbell quote and completely miss the mark with
it. Oh, yeah. No, follow your bliss has been completely fucked at this point.
Right. And but that one quote about you must be willing to give up the life that you planned in order to live the life that is waiting for you.
That's
and that's
great.
It's supposed to be a warning, you know, to those people that like, my parents want me to be a doctor, so I'm going to go and be a doctor.
Yeah.
And they end up being miserable because what they really wanted to do, what really would have made them whole and complete, was to like go off and be a youth soccer coach and make paintings. Right.
Yeah, right, right.
And me being the kind of person I am, I've always been like, I don't want the shit that you tell me I should want. You know, go off and go to college and get married and get a good job and have a family. I'm a writer, goddammit.
Yeah.
I've always kind of been that person who perpetually wanted to enter the wood at the place of my own choosing rather than follow the established path. Right?
Right.
And so that Campbell quote about you must be willing to give up the life you planned, it's like, but I planned to do the thing in the dark, dark wood by myself. And you're telling me that the life that is waiting for me might be the path everybody else took that led to the cubicle farm and dying at 60 of a heart attack?
Maybe.
No.
I mean, not necessarily that. That's the other extreme. But I mean, look at right now. Look who you're working for. But yet you own a house. And it's a nice house. You know? Like,
right.
Maybe
so that's,
some
why do you think I'm
that.
Struggling with that quote and what exactly it means?
For sure.
You know, yes, I have that, but I also live alone. I can't seem to get a date. I'm 51, and I never planned on not having kids. It just happened that way. And now it's like, but I I just didn't want to have kids when I was financially unstable, emotionally destructive.
Totally makes sense. Yeah.
And I didn't want to make the mistakes that my parents made because they followed the, you know,
sure,
get married and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they were married for 27 years and they divorced right when I was 22. And it just fucked up my whole sense of like,
my idea,
my perception of how to love and be intimate has been wrong this whole time.
Whew.
Right. So, yeah. So here I am. I'm 51. And do I just give up on everything that I wanted because it's developing so late for me?
Well, what you want might have to be in a different way than what
right.
you planned.
But you got
to
right? struggle and figure that out, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, so yeah, exactly. So that's kind of where this novel is going. It's addressing kind of concept.
How cool. How intense.
So, and I just started that today. Well,
nice.
I started the novel version of that today. I've been trying to write it and coming up with scenes and doing other stuff and when I thought it was going to be a screenplay, but
mm-hmm.
usually when I decide on the form and the structure, that's when I know what I'm doing, which brings us to the whole crafty thing.
Ah, it's not what you planned.
So like
yes,
I said, I know we've been talked about this. We wanted to talk about craft in a way. We wanted to kind of take the focus of the show from, you know, the business side of it.
Yes, exactly.
That's important for those of us who are outwriters, who are out on the fringe at the moment. But it's also something that we're really not in a position to affect change regarding.
Right, that's true. That's true.
Not that we're in a position to affect change on anything, really. All we can control is what we are creating and putting out into the inboxes of
yes.
agents and editors and hoping that it resonates at some point.
Right. That's all we can really do.
And that comes down to this idea of craft and
right.
talking about that. And actually talking about the things that make us, not just because we exist outside of the mainstream by virtue of our physicality in relation to it. We're not getting published, i.e.,
sure.
anymore. We're struggling to get the next thing out. But also outriders in regards to our kind of our philosophy and our approach to things. We're doing something, at least I hope both of us are, of trying to stretch and not fall into the kind of the standard mainstream, here's how you build a book and put, and actually trying to
yes.
create a unique art that is
something
representative
yeah.
of us in a
yes
in more than one way.
Yes, no, I'm agreeing with you. Yeah. Absolutely.
Oddly enough, the You Are Not So Smart podcast today, or maybe it was over the weekend, released an episode where they were talking to someone, and the whole premise, and I'll put this in the show notes, where they were talking about how people can have a conversation and they're using the same language on the surface, but they actually have wildly different understandings of what those words mean and entail. So like you could have two experts of penguins talking to each other about penguins, but their concepts and terms and everything that they have associated with those two words, they might not be talking exactly about the same thing.
Okay.
I see. Because they have slightly different nuance, different details, different perceptions of those words and understanding of those words. And so I'm sitting there listening, thinking, this kind of goes right into what I thought we should talk about today with, you know, craft and getting our craft books together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And actually trying to negotiate and define the term in such a way that we both kind of understand what we're talking about and not.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we were planning this episode, you had asked me like, what was the difference between
formula and
form, right?
No, it was something about what was it? It was like, yeah. Anyway, I didn't have the same idea about the difference between these two
right.
aspects of it that you did.
So
yeah.
that was kind of what drove me for this outline here. So and that's immediately got me thinking about this about a good metaphor to use to get us kind of on the same page.
Right.
And I thought I could, at first, you know, it was like, oh, I'll use the painting one from my giant manifesto essay. But I might actually end up rewriting the essay to use this metaphor, or maybe I'll employ this metaphor in a different spot in the essay.
I kind of like this metaphor better, yeah.
But the painting one works too.
It does. Yeah, no, it does.
Writing as baking actually, because it fits a little bit more for what we're talking about here.
Yeah. And I like it as baking as opposed to like as a recipe for like cooking.
Right.
I think baking is a much more like exact. I like this. Anyway, go on.
Okay. So the first part of this is that when you go to bake something, cakes, cookies, pies, whatever, you have certain fundamental ingredients that exist in all of those things. You have some kind of liquid or moisture,
right,
and flour,
yes,
or something that's, you know, you have an agent and something that binds that stuff together.
You have the wet and the dry, yeah.
And then you add various things to it. So, you know,
sure,
baking soda, baking powder, sugar, salt, yeast, water and flour and yeast makes bread. Milk and eggs and flour makes a cake or type of thing. You know, flour,
sure,
and butter and something else tends to make a cookie. But you basically have the same sets of ingredients to,
right,
start off with.
And it has to be in the right amount of like measurements.
Or it could be guesswork as too. But that basically in baking, those types of things correlate to, you know, character, plot, setting, metaphor, allusion, all the components,
time, yeah.
Time, you know, pacing, all those are all the
yeah,
ingredients of any story, no matter what. You also have to, now, a really good baker, just like a really good writer, always starts from scratch. They take a little bit of whatever they need from all of that stuff to make what they're going to make.
Yeah, when you're first learning how to bake, you take the box.
Or if you're just an amateur cooker who's just making,
right,
something to entertain or whatever, you go,
yeah,
and get,
yeah,
the boxed mix.
Just add a little because
it has
oil
all the stuff.
Whatever.
But,
yeah,
you know, eggs, oil, milk, whatever a thing calls for.
It's all there before you.
All,
yeah,
the, you know, the flour and the sugar and the salt and the floof,
that's
powder,
right,
it's already mixed there for you. You don't have to
it
worry
is.
About those proportions.
That's why I like this metaphor so much. Yeah.
And then, so craft then is the way you combine or process or mold or mix those ingredients together to make your story. That's craft. That's technique.
Right.
Form is your container. So whatever it is that you take all the,
right,
ingredients and mix them together with, the form then is the baking pan. So whether you're making a sheet cake or a bundt cake or muffins.
Or cookies.
Or cookies, which are a free form thing, or scones, or, you know,
right,
if you're doing a bread and you do a loaf pan, or you do just a round bread, however you shape the bread,
right,
and that can,
right,
be, you know, a free form that's hand done, or you've got a specific pan for it. That's the form, right? That correlates,
yes,
to whether you're writing a novel or a novel in stories or a collection of short stories or.
Yeah.
And here's the part that might just piss off some people.
Okay.
All of that stuff that we've talked about so far, that exists in all stories.
Yes,
all,
right,
the same ingredients, whatever. Genre is like the frosting or the non-base ingredients that you add to make a specific type of thing. So like the stuff,
right,
that you,
right,
add to a base cookie to make a snickerdoodle, that's genre.
You add chocolate chips
chocolate
to it,
chips,
and you have
make it a genre.
Sci-fi.
Right. The type of frosting or how you stack, you know, the cakes into a layers and do whatever, that's the way you present that after you've put it in the form and whatever. All the floofy stuff on top that makes, you know, one cake look different from another.
Yeah.
That's genre.
Now I would add, it's not as unnecessary as you're saying, like, you know, a chocolate chip cookie,
right,
is different than a raisin cookie, but yes, but the cookie base with the cinnamon and the vanilla, that's the same whether you add the raisins or chocolate chips to it. Makes it a different genre,
makes it a different,
right,
type of cookie. It's still a,
yes,
cookie,
yes, Right, exactly. Right?
A cake is still a cake, whether it's like a three-layer wedding cake or, you know,
or a
sheet cake or a pancake or a loaf cake. You know, I have a loaf pan that I do both bread and little, you know, cakes in.
Quick breads, yeah.
Genre is that stuff
that
doesn't, it just makes the thing look or taste different than the base.
Right, but the base is going to be the same.
It's still a cake.
Yep, it's still a cake.
It could be a yellow cake, could be a chocolate cake, could be a white cake, could be red velvet. All of that stuff that makes it different than another cake is genre. But basically...
Yes, agreed.
The ingredients, the way you mix it all together, the form, that's universal.
That's
no
cake.
Matter what, that's cake, that's cookie, that's a bread, that's whatever. No matter what else you do to it.
Right.
It's still that.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I think that's why we have the genre wars and the arguments that we have, is that because there are a lot of people that get into, and we've talked about this before, what we call the subliterary genres, right? And they don't pay as much attention to the ingredients and the technique. They have the mix and they have an established method for putting it together, a strict recipe, right? Like they were making chicken cacciatore or something like that, and had to, and they pop out with something, and it's predictable, it's formulaic, it's easily recognizable, and not as satisfying in some ways. In my opinion, I mean, that's the thing that, you know, when I find really good science fiction, yay! But most of it, I'm just like, just like I'm getting now with a lot of literary fiction out there. It's just like,
Most literary fiction I'm just bored by. Yeah, exactly.
I know the tone. I start reading the paragraph and it's like, I know what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
Right.
But you have to understand, I love this metaphor too, because like that also makes it very clear. It's like somebody goes, oh, well, obviously oatmeal raisin cookies are completely an inferior type of cookie to chocolate chip. Like, obviously. It's like, no, they're just different.
It's just different. A different
thing you put in there. It's like, it's not, I mean, maybe you had a bad one, but like, you know.
there's
that's
almost,
why I like that so much.
There's
it just
almost
makes
no
so much
such
sense
thing as
me.
A bad cookie.
No. Yeah. And if you had one, I'm sorry.
It's
I'm
usually
sorry
because
it
got, it was burnt or...
Or it was like... Underdone. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So like, I totally understand that.
Right. Same thing with a
cake.
And
I agree.
You know?
Like, right. Exactly. So cool. So yeah. So like the craft means all of the ingredients that we include in the recipe.
Well, the craft is the technique and the way that the baker puts all the stuff together.
Yes, that's what I mean. So like all of the aspects of it that you need to include to make it a thing.
Two bakers will have the exact same ingredients and make a cake, and it's still going to be different because that person does something differently. They've figured something out.
Right.
Or maybe they've got a little, you know, wrist action, flick, something they do, whatever, to, you know, to take those base ingredients and mix them together in such a way that they act differently.
Just an extra dash of cinnamon, or like maybe they just turn up their oven 2 degrees more and it just makes all the difference.
Or maybe
they figured it out.
Beat the eggs a few extra times, you know, so there's more air in it, or, you know.
Something like that. But they did that through practice, right? They did that through probably through
practice
to
and
make
experimentation and things like this. This is why, you know, I both understand, yes, in a way we have been taught craft in all of the workshops that we've taken, and that we have, you know, read texts by well-established writers. We've read texts by our classmates and discussed, well, if you did this slightly differently, if you adjusted the way you presented this character, and we've kind of backed our way and talked about craft at some times. And maybe we've occasionally, you know, pulled out some of the books that we have on each of our list. But I don't know that anyone has, you know, taught craft in that kind of strict way that you might teach accounting
or chemistry. I feel like I've gotten that. So I think you and I have gone through a different experience. throughout the poetry program, I really did feel like I got a lot of that.
And did you rebel against it?
No, because what I saw was a lot of really good cakes. And the feedback I was getting about the techniques to make that cake myself, I saw as valid.
Right.
Especially in the very first workshop I ever took, which was in poetry, but it was in undergrad. I was in a graduate level workshop as an undergrad. And the things that she had me do with my work, I was floored by, and it made me take a step back. But then, of course, the other things that we were reading in that class, mostly it was our peer stuff, but we read her work. We read other established work too. And she would actually be very good at prescribing, like it's a medicine, but prescribing readings that she felt connected to what we were trying to do as well. And so what the feedback I was getting for what I should be doing with my work really made sense to me, like structure craft wise. I'm trying to think of a specific example, so I'm not being vague.
No, that's fine.
Yeah. One of my longer poems, she was like, okay, so this is where your poem begins. It's two stanzas down. This sentence is actually where this poem begins. You're tooling around with a lot of different ideas in the beginning. It's kind of mushy. You're not really sure what you're writing about here. That's where you know what you're writing about. Start the poem here. So like just stuff like that, like specific things, like craft stuff. Like that's just one specific example. I can't think of more, but like in our MFA program, I got a lot of feedback that was just like, oh yeah, this needs lots of revision. Here's a thing to do with it. It's not just this sucks, you know, check your commas. It was just like, okay, so here's the center, and especially with her working with my stuff recently, it was like, okay, what's the center of this cake? What are you trying to make? Are you trying to make a lemon cake? Are you trying to make a lemon poppy seed cake? Because that's like, what's going on here? And it would be up to me to try to figure that out. I don't know. I feel like I've gotten some good education in that. Specifically in the MFA program, but we did take lots of different classes. So
what I find interesting here, though, is that going back to the podcast that I mentioned before, is that ostensibly we're throwing out the word craft, but when I hear you mention those things, what those trigger in me is the first one, like knowing where to start the story. That's not so much craft as judgment, is how I would interpret that.
Oh, I disagree.
Right. And, you know, deciding what the center of the cake is, I don't see that as a craft decision, but as vision, having a clear vision for the story.
But how is that not craft? How is not having a clear... So say you write a story and it's...
Because to me, craft is you can have a vision... Yeah. And not be able to get there, not be able to do it. And the way that you get there, the way that you make that clear to the reader is craft. Yes. You can have a clear understanding of what your center is, but not have the skill or the craft to get there, to not have the capability, the technique, the tools to get there.
Right.
Same thing with, you know, knowing where to start the story. Craft is how you structured that sentence in that beginning up to the fluff before that is, like she said, yes, it's figuring this stuff out, but that's not craft. That's just practice. That's shedding the thing and making a judgment call. You judged the beginning here. And she said, no, it's down here. And that doesn't really have anything to do with the way that you've structured the sentence or structured the poem. It's that you've put a stuff here because of a lack of vision and a lack of confidence, which is separate from, to me, in my understanding, craft.
I don't know that that's true, because like if you're talking about a narrative poem, well, if we're talking poetry, I feel like that's knowing where to start it is totally a part of craft. And like, I did bring in a first draft because that was the idea. It was a workshop, right? You bring in an early draft.
Right.
So like the part of learning craft is to go through that opening stuff and seeing what does need to be kept and what doesn't. That is part of craft. Revision is absolutely part of craft.
Revision is craft, but that's...
Structuring the poem is totally a part of craft. And because I brought it in, it was raw. I was like, oh, I can see that. Yeah. Then I was able to begin it. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, I understand. But like I said, I think we have slightly...
I don't know how that's not craft, in other words.
That's fine. Not trying to convince you otherwise. I'm just saying we have a different understanding.
Sweet.
We have a different concept of it because, like I said, I don't see that as craft.
What is it?
That's the pre-work. That's the judgment. That's all part of the vision. That's part of figuring out what the core is, what it is you want to do.
Oh, it's pre-craft.
And then once you know what you want to do, craft is figuring out how to do it.
Okay. I think I see what you're saying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Somebody who has no craft, skill, whatever, could have a very clear vision of where they want to start the story and what they want the story to be. But if they don't have good craft, they can't get there.
Right. Yes. Right. Right.
No matter what. Got there because you have craft, but you did your searching for your vision and your starting point before you got to that point, before you understood that, right? And then once you had to have someone point out, go, no, it starts here. Here's where you get focused. And like, oh, and then once you got focused, you knew exactly what tools, you know, what methods, what techniques to employ to get that nugget refined and whatever. To me, that's craft.
I see. Huh.
Right.
Okay. So the pre-writing, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Anybody can have, this is one of the things that newbie writers who don't actually write always have. I've got a great idea and I've been doing all this research and planning.
Oh yeah.
But they never write it.
Or the people that I can think of at least one person that you and I encountered in our MFA program who could not take any kind of feedback because they didn't know. All they had was this beautiful vision and they thought they were doing it and they couldn't possibly see how they weren't, let alone know how to actually put forth the vision that they thought they were already doing. It's this whole Dunning-Kruger thing. So yeah. Okay.
We both know who exactly we're talking about.
Yes.
I don't necessarily disagree with you that stuff you were talking about isn't craft, but it's kind of like, to me, it's the subconscious part of it, the stuff that your brain has to learn how to.
Well, there's a lot of different phases of craft, right? I mean, there's the generative part, there's the revision part, there's the structural.
So for me, what you were talking about, to me, that would relate to deciding what ingredients to assemble before you start making the thing you wanted to make. So figuring out your center, figuring out, you know, where you actually want to start, that's like going, well, I need, for what I want to make, I need eggs, flour, milk, sugar, baking soda. And then once you've got all of that, figuring out what you want to make, yes, that's part of craft, but that's the subconscious part. That's like deciding whether you're going to make a muffin or a cake or a pie or a cookie or whatever.
Uh-huh. But the base ingredients were there. It was just like, oh, no, this is a muffin, not a cake.
And so, so to me, where I think our difference is on that understanding is that I sit back and go, what do I want to make and what do I need to make it? And you were starting off with like, well, let's just throw some stuff together and, oh, it's going to be a cake. and then you proceed to make a cake. And I'm more of the kind of person that craft doesn't start until I've decided what I'm going to make.
Okay. Yeah.
And for you, it starts with like, which is like a totally flippant way to describe it. I'm sorry.
No, but that's actually, I'm different with when it comes to nonfiction.
Right.
I always outline and plan very, very heavily before I write anything nonfiction. I never go organic. I never just throw shit against the wall and see what sticks with nonfiction. I always do it with poetry. So that's interesting.
Right. You've got a list of your craft books that you have. You sent me a picture of it. And I sent you my giant list of craft books.
I will make those pictures into a list for you. It'll be a lot easier to handle.
Because okay. I think even though we didn't mention them all, let's put the list, each of for our sure. list, in the show notes for everybody. But mm-hmm. while we're wrapping up here, of those books, what have been, which ones have been your most impactful? Which ones have been the most important, the most significant to you as a writer?
Yeah. Strangely enough, The Mammoth on Directing Film has been immensely impactful to me.
Oh.
Because what he does is he's like, pare away the bullshit. What is this actually about? What's actually happening?
Too bad he's turned fascist.
I know. And I hate that I still like his work because I shouldn't. I really shouldn't. But this little thin volume is very, very, very helpful. It's been fundamental for me, especially because as a young person, I was very much into fantasy, and fantasy can very easily get into, I am copying Tolkien and I'm getting
right.
very, very, very purple and very unnecessary. And it gets to be over ornate if you're not careful. And so his book really helped me to pare it down. Like what is the essential, what's the seed, what's the essential thing that's going on here? And so that's been, sorry, but really, really fundamental to me. The other one for my memoir and for my new, now it's been like, what, I don't know, four years I've been writing nonfiction, but my, to me, new genre of nonfiction, it's been Lopate's To Show and to Tell. And that's where he breaks it down as far as like, hey, you know, like show, don't tell is cool and all. Like you should definitely have concrete details. You should definitely make sure that your reader can picture what's going on. But also sometimes you just need to sit down and just summarize the shit. Like, you know, like sometimes you just need yep. to do that. And that's actually okay. If you do that really well, if you're a good writer and you do that well, that's actually necessary. You can't show everything because then you're not going to be able to communicate effectively. And then the third one, I mean, I love Ray Bradbury. He's great, but his writing book is rather unhinged, as everything he writes is. And that's why I love him, because he's fucking unhinged. But it's The Bell, backwards and forwards, or Ball. Is it Ball? Oh my God. I don't even know this author. Yeah, Ball. Backwards and forwards. That one's about not writing, but reading. Mm-hmm. But what it does is it tells you exactly how stories are composed. And so Backwards and Forwards is all about how to read a play.
Right.
And so he tells you about, you should read it backwards. And he uses Hamlet as an example, just because like most people have actually been forced to read Hamlet. So like we kind of know what the story is. But he talks about triggers and heaps. He talks about what happens to make another thing happen. And so his description of construction of a plot is like really essential for writing of any kind of story. He really tells you how one thing leads to another thing happening, to another thing happening, to another thing happening. Like how is a story actually composed? So I would say those are the big three for me.
I have a lot.
You.
Which is why
I pared it down to three.
Yeah, I don't think I can.
I like another asshole, The Sense of Style, Steven Pinker.
Oh, yeah.
Also great, but whatever. Okay, anyway. Okay, so.
Oh, my
turn. So how many did you choose?
Well, I have.
I was able to take it three.
You had three books. I have three categories.
Oh, okay. That's fair.
So the first one I want to talk about is, you know, the classic, The Rhetoric of Fiction by Wayne Booth. Now, I've not read this cover to cover, like the whole thing. I treat this like a reference work, like a dictionary or a thesaurus. And so if I want to kind of, if I hear somebody, you know, flap their gums about something, I go to The Rhetoric of Fiction to make sure I'm, you know, kind of understanding what they're talking about or, okay, you know, to kind of get, because I feel like The Rhetoric of Fiction is actually the foundation of the way we talk about fiction in workshops.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
It's the common parlance and language of the American creative writing workshop. So I always treat this as a good reference, but I don't read it cover to cover or know it by heart. The other category I have is actually a series of books that I have not read all of yet, but I really like the idea of them, the concept. They're small, they're digestible, they're on individual topics, and it's from Grey Wolf Press, and it's the Art of series.
Oh, yeah, I saw those on your list. Okay, so, that's interesting.
Like The Art of Time in Fiction by Joan Silber. The Art of Perspective, which is Who Tells the Story by Christopher Castellani.
That's cool.
So it's all a bunch of very, you know, well-regarded writers writing
like
about a certain
topic.
So Charles Baxter did The Art of Subtext.
Cool.
Stacey D'Erasmo did The Art of Intimacy, which was the book where I learned about William Maxwell's novel So Long, See You Tomorrow, which changed a whole bunch of stuff for me.
Oh, okay. Right?
And then Peter Ho Davies did The Art of Revision. And there's others out there for this, but these are the ones, you know, I have. And I definitely recommend those to any writer that just wants to read and learn a little bit more about certain aspects of craft and certain writers' perspectives on it and things like that. I've gotten a lot out of the ones that I've read.
Great.
They're not, you know, the most important books, but they're definitely ones that have helped, you know, open up my sense of perspective and added to my toolkit, you know.
Well, they sound important. Yeah.
So my three most important ones. The first one, and I'll do them in chronological order.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Okay. So the first book that was really important to me as a craft book for fiction, oddly enough, was a book of art criticism.
Oh.
Ways of Seeing by John Berger.
Yeah, okay.
So this is, and it has a lot to do with, again, perspective and vision and interpreting. And it's, to me, what has always been helpful is adjusting that sense of perception that a narrator has to have. So you're assuming, whether you're, you know, doing to adopt Wayne Booth, because that's the one everybody's most familiar with, that third person, you know, limited omniscient, you know, or a focalization, right, through a specific character. That comes with this idea of this person seeing things. And one of the things that Berger talks about in The Way of Seeing is that a painting has always been two things, that it has been a representation of a thing at a certain period of time and how the artist perceived that
thing. Yeah.
So there's two things going on with that. And that applies to fiction. So as you, as a writer, if you're filtering through a particular character, not only, however, who's controlling that flow of information? They're recording what they see, but they're also recording their impressions of it, how they see it. Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that has always been really good for me with, you know, creating metaphors and allusions and getting that right. Because one character is going to see an event and have a certain interpretation of it, and making sure that those are different and deviant and just, you know, unique enough so that they're not me.
Right.
Yeah, but Berger has a lot of good stuff. And of course, plays into that fact that, you know, even though we are writing words on a paper, we're still in a way creating a visual image, because it's triggering that thing in the imagination. You're still perceiving and seeing things.
Yes, totally, totally.
That's what was really important. The next one I stumbled across was Narrative Discourse, Gerard Genet, which introduced me to structuralism.
Yeah.
Particularly his ideas of focalization. And of course, what he breaks it down is order, duration, frequency, mood, and voice. This has a lot to do with, you know, time. So this is where I started to understand that, you know, a novel does not have to be this linear progression up Freytag's fucking triangle.
No, definitely not.
This correlated to also how I began to understand Ondaatje when I was reading Ondaatje's fiction, is that, you know, he plays with order, duration, which are elements of time and perception. Uh-huh. You know, how long is the scene? How much time does the scene cover? What order are those scenes structured in order to create the mood or the tone or the perception? Because Narrative Discourse actually is an essay in method, and what he used was Proust's Remembrance of Things Past.
Yes.
And because that thing fucks with time.
Yes.
Right?
We were just talking about this in my class just last week. We were just like literally zooming about this.
Yeah.
This particular thing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anyway,
and to me, you know, because the way we perceive things, you go back to the way of seeing, and then you throw in Genet with this idea that within a single paragraph, even though you might ostensibly be in the past tense, in your prose, there's actually elements of time shift and duration and compression and expansion, you know, and you get into what Genet calls ellipses or iterative ellipses and all this other stuff. Like, it's a certain control and telescoping of time if you say something like, every day that summer I walked to the pool, as opposed to I walked to the pool, right? It creates a different tone, a different feel, a different sense of perception about what the story's being going on.
Yep.
So this is why I tend to not follow the typical linear simplistic narrative. There's so much, you know, Proustian, Ondaatje-esque, you know, time compressionist shit that I put into the fiction. Because
Wait, did you just say Proustian and Ondaatje-esque in one like sentence? Holy shit.
Because I am that kind of a pretentious prick.
God damn. Having said that, I absolutely approve of those two. Yes. Okay. Excellent. What else?
But then Ondaatje came out with this book, The Conversations. Walter Murch and the Art of Film Editing.
I didn't know about this book. This could go right alongside my ball or my mammoth.
And so, you know, when we've had conversations where I've talked about how the novel seems stuck in a 19th century mode of you know, the train traveling through the countryside, and so everything comes at you in a linear, you know, steady pace or whatever. This was the book that helped me develop that concept that this has made novels stagnant, right? That 19th century model is still being employed. You have some people that'll fuck around with it and shit like that.
Yeah. Do you think that movies had something to do with that?
Movies definitely changed it. Yeah. Movies, because the thing is that, you know, jump cuts and flashes in time, the way they edit film. There's another book by Murch himself that's good, and I like it. It helped me develop the ideas that started with this one, but it's called In the Blink of an Eye, Walter Murch, and a Perspective on Film Editing. Recommended as well, but not my top.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if it was Murch exactly, or Ondaatje, or some other thing. It might have been a Sontag essay on photography or something. I don't know. But when movies first appeared, there were certain moments where people would react to what was going on in the film, like a train rushing towards the camera or a guy shooting at it. And people would be like, oh, and react to it. But
because it was so different.
Because that was kind of shocking. But no one freaked out in early movies when the filmmakers made sudden jump cuts between one time and place and another time and place without a transition. Nobody freaked out. And the reason they theorized that that was is because it actually it reminded us of dreaming.
Oh,
because
sure.
Our brains, even before we had film and television, would dream in this disjointed, jump-cutty fashion.
Yeah. Well, that's how memory works. Like, you work with memory a lot in your work.
So why the fuck aren't we... Why are so many fiction writers still building this plotting, you know, fuck narrative? You know, that's just like, start at the beginning and go to... No, start it. You actually want to embrace in media res? Just drop it. Just throw us in the fucking pool, man.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll figure it out. Don't tell us the characters' names. Don't tell us anything. Yeah. Just throw us in the goddamn pool. Because that's the way movies work.
Yeah.
Right? Only in a fucking novel, in the first paragraph, do you get the character's full fucking name and like a total fucking description of their emotional disposition.
Or their physicality. It's like, right? Why is this person thinking about their last name and how they look?
That is totally a question of craft. Why the fuck have you made that decision?
Yeah.
Just like with the movie trailer, when I pick up a book, I've read the blurb, your description inside the flap.
Yeah, right here. I have that.
I know that the main character is named Neptune. I know he's 19. I kind of have a rough idea of what's going to happen in the book. Why the fuck are you wasting the first two pages telling me that all over again?
Right.
You're boring the shit out of me.
Right.
And I'm not going to read it.
So boring.
Just jump right in.
Yeah.
Anyway.
This is great. This is a good conversation. Thank you. Yes.
Yes.
Just push us in.
Just throw them in the pool.
Just push me in. that'll be the subtitle for this episode.
Yeah. Just throw them in the pool. Push me in the pool. Go. Do it. I mean, fuck. I mean, I picked up your book because the cover was interesting. This whole bullshit about don't judge a book by a cover.
Because you
of course you do.
Always judge a book by its cover.
I am not going to pick up and read a book that has silvery foil on the cover. I'm just not going to.
Oh, yeah. It's okay.
Because that's usually something that's like men's fiction because it has some flashy like,
oh, no.
Right? That tells me right away.
Because it's gunmetal. Because the cover is gunmetal, right?
I'm not gonna rip that up.
Fuck that.
Lots of pastel cartoon characters. Probably not gonna pick that up.
No.
Nope. Because that's probably chick lit.
I probably won't either.
And now,
yeah, I don't like chick lit either.
Before we go any further, does that mean I don't read women? Fuck no. I read
a lot of women. Oh, you read lots of women. Yeah.
I just don't read the things that get marketed to everybody as chick lit, like it's about shopping and relationships.
Well, chick lit is not women authors. That's a very different thing.
Oh, no. Most of it are. We actually had a chick lit book club that focused on it. I know who... I'll have you talk to Anne next time you're here.
No, that's not what I mean. What I mean is the genre chick lit does not necessitate, like you can find good women authors without having to go to chick lit.
Exactly.
You know, that's what I'm trying to say.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Absolutely. You are definitely right.
That's what I'm trying to say. I wasn't being very clear.
But there, as a formulaic genre, the chick lit, which is the pastel covers, usually with the cartoon, couple on the thing.
Yeah.
Pass that by.
Yeah.
Pass that by. Silver foil on the cover. Pass that by.
Silver foil. Dude lit.
Pass that by. But once you pick it up and you read it, you kind of...
Before... Is it chick lit and dick lit?
There is a dick lit. What would be dick lit or lad lit is what they, I think, officially call it.
I think chick lit and dick lit is great because it rhymes.
Oh, it would definitely be better if they called it dick lit. You might actually get guys to read it if you called it dick lit.
That's true. Not to be confused with the eminent and brilliant and wonderful Chuck Tingle.
Oh my God.
God bless him.
Yeah.
His recent work, Chuck Tingle's recent work, is called something like Being Bisexually Satisfied by My Work-Life Balance. It's kind of like a woman and a man manifesting his work-life balance. That man is doing something very important.
To our five listeners out there, if you've got some particular craft topic you want us to talk about, shoot in us
all
a message.
You.
Shoot us a note. You know where to find us. Doesn't matter, whoever. And we'll go from there. So thanks for listening. I'll see you next month, Jen.
See you next month.
The Outrider podcast is recorded by Jason Quinn Malott and Jen Zuko. Audio is cleaned up and refined by Heather Ann Eden. Our show is hosted by podbean.com.